disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, October 3rd, 2018. We have an action-packed episode for you today. After headlines in the news, we present to you a total of four interviews. The first is with somebody from Tidewater IWW who discusses their experience while participating in autonomous disaster relief efforts in the town of Lumberton, North Carolina, working alongside and in solidarity with Native organizations and networks. Next, we talk to somebody in Denver, Colorado, who discusses the recent mobilization against the Proud Boys. We then turn towards the East, where we talk with somebody from the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, who brings us up to speed with efforts to support the Vaughn 17, a group of prisoners going to trial next week that are facing serious charges for taking part in a prison uprising at the Vaughn Correctional Facility in early 2017. We talk about how people are mobilizing to support them and how you can plug in. Lastly, we speak with somebody about this weekend's past anti-fascist mobilization in Ohio that was successful in blocking a far-right march at Kent State. But first, let's get to the news. While the Trump administration has presented itself as climate deniers, or those that would refute the idea of human-caused climate change, a new report spells out that in reality the administration does believe in climate change. It just thinks that things are so far gone, it can't do anything about it. As the Washington Post wrote, quote, last month, deep in a 500-page environmental impact statement, the Trump administration made a startling assumption. On the current course, the planet will warm a disastrous 7 degrees by the end of the century. But the administration did not offer this dire forecast, premised on the idea that the world will fail to cut greenhouse gas emissions as part of an argument to combat climate change. Just the opposite. The analysis assumes the planet's fate is already sealed. The report then argues that various pro-fossil fuel policies promoted by the Trump administration should be passed, because after all, they are just a drop in the bucket of the problem of global warming, which is already on a collision course with oblivion anyway. This is not the first time that the Trump administration has commissioned studies which have affirmed the existence of climate change. For instance, in 2017, quote, in one internal White House memo, officials wondered whether it would be best to simply ignore such analyses. Since the Enlightenment and the spread of democracy, which by and large has only helped masquerade the nature of colonial class society and authority, we have been told a fairy tale of the, quote, social contract. It is a bedtime story, we are told, that we trade certain freedoms for security from the state. But in reality, the people that are driving us off a cliff literally know what is happening, but have no desire to turn course. In doing so, in the eyes of everyone under the state's rule, they should lose total legitimacy in having any say over our lives, and their authority should be seen as what it is, an occupation of force based on the threat of violence and imprisonment. According to a report from the New York Times, quote, in shelters from Kansas to New York, hundreds of migrant children have been routed in the middle of the night in recent weeks and loaded onto buses with backpacks and snacks for a cross-country journey to their new home, a barren tent city on the sprawling patch of desert in West Texas. Until now, most undocumented children being held by federal immigration authorities have been housed in private foster homes or shelters, sleeping two or three to a room. They received formal schooling and regular visits with legal representatives assigned to their immigration cases. But in the rows of sand-colored tents in Texas, children in groups of 20, separated by gender, sleep lined up in bunks. There is no school. The children are given workbooks, and they have no obligation to complete them. Access to legal services is limited. In other news, Forbes reported on the first ever example of police with the warrant being able to force someone to unlock their phone using facial recognition technology. The Trump administration this week stopped giving visas to same-sex partners of foreign diplomats and UN officials. Amazon is hoping to dodge criticism by giving workers a meager raise to $15 an hour, and the Trump administration is trying to weaken standards of how much radiation one can be exposed to. Meanwhile, NAFTA has been reimagined between the US, Canada, and Mexico, and is now being used as another weapon in the ongoing trade war with China to outmaneuver their global supply chains. And now, resistance and repression news. Neo-Nazis involved in the Blue Bloc we've seen at far-right rallies in Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston have been exposed by anti-fascists. Check our show notes for a report. In Texas, Autonomous Student Media continues with their weekly roundup column. Check our show notes for a link. In the LA area, the Black Rose Anarchist Federation and the IWW are distributing beautiful pro-strike posters to teachers in the lead-up to a large strike. On September 27th, a group of far-right militia members attacked with pepper spray a group of DSA members who were meeting at a restaurant. See our show notes for various reports and a link to an article by Unicorn Riot about the incident. Local anti-fascists also have doxed those involved. See our show notes for a link with more information. A new website has been launched with info on where to drop off supplies that will go to feed into autonomous mutual aid disaster relief efforts. Go to maddistronc.org to see the new website. Protests and walkouts are breaking out in D.C. and across the U.S. against Kavanaugh, including sit-ins and disruptions where the hearings are taking place. Harvard Law also announced that they are canceling a class taught by Kavanaugh himself. On September 28th, a march in Oaxaca, Mexico took place to demand abortion access. According to the Water Protector Legal Collective, quote, Michael Rattler Marcus was sentenced yesterday to a 36-month federal prison term pursuant to a non-cooperating plea deal, becoming the third water protector arrested in relation to the DAPL pipeline resistance at Standing Rock to be sentenced to a substantial prison term. Protests in Carbondale, Illinois, against a former member of the neo-Nazi Traditionalist Worker Party caused the Nazi to flee the campus. A march in New York City was repressed by police during People's Monday as people took to the streets to remember Bothan Jean, who was killed by an off-duty police officer entering his apartment. The Lo Ella V camp blockaded the entrance to the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources against the BioBridge pipeline. One arrest was made and one person was injured by the police. On September 29th, League of the South had a small unannounced rally after canceling their public rally. Their inability to hold a public demonstration would be lampooned later that night on Saturday Night Live. In Portland, Oregon, Rose City Antifa held a successful public fundraiser, netting over $1,000. At Kent State in Ohio, over 300 anti-fascists and anti-racists held it down in the face of a heavily armed militia members, Proud Boys, and far-right goons. See our audio report and interview on the mobilization later in the program. In Brooklyn, New York, Mass Bailout NYC held a rally against prisons and mass incarceration, which led to a march. On September 30th, the Front Range John Brown Gun Club of Redneck Revolt held another free food and harm reduction event, which was attended by over 300 people. They wrote of the event on Facebook, "Thank you to everyone who came out today. Roughly 300 community members came to hang out, share a meal, and get some supplies. To those who were present when one of our neighbors had a medical situation, we administered Narcan, brought her back to the point where she was moving and making noise, and her pulse came back. The paramedics came and took her to the hospital. We don't have an update, but feel confident that she's okay. We have Narcan at distros for this reason. Harm reduction works. Harm reduction saves lives." Protests broke out in Portland, Oregon, in the face of the police killing of an African-American man, Patrick Kimmons. Demonstrations remain ongoing. On October 1st, rent strikers in Flemington Park held a rally outside of landlord and tenant board. Tenants continue to push for demands for landlords to make needed repairs and also are fighting evictions. Follow hashtag Flemington Park Rent Strike for more info on social media. The anti-police occupation calling for hashtag disarm PSU remains ongoing, is entering its second week at Portland State University. Meanwhile, in Philadelphia, around the same time that neo-Nazis are known to hold a rally around a Leif Erikson statue, persons unknown pulled it down, and right literally into the river. As Idavox wrote, quote, "Last night, the Viking statue had been pulled from the pedestal it stood for almost 98 years and is now submerged in a river. Just a week before the Columbus Day weekend, which is often the weekend that Keystone United or Keystone State Skinheads holds their event. According to 6ABC News, the statue was pulled down by a rope by unknown persons into the river. It remains there as police investigate. The GOP office in Rockford, Illinois was covered in graffiti reading, quote, "rape and shame," an obvious reference to Kavanaugh. A fund has been set up for the person facing charges for the graffiti. You can see a link to that in our show notes. In Chicago, vigils and demonstrations continue outside of migrant detention centers operated by the Heartland nonprofit. Mass rallies in New York against Kavanaugh took the streets, many chanting anti-capitalist slogans. One person on Twitter wrote, quote, "a thousand people chanting 'eat the rich' outside of the effing Yale Club, best day ever." In the Hellbender Autonomous Zone, the Tree Sit is now 29 days old and continuing. Check out Appalachians Against Pipelines for daily updates. In Philadelphia, anarchists and anti-fascists helped organize an anti-Trump march as the Fascito made a brief appearance. In Mexico City and Oaxaca, anarchists and anti-fascists took part in mobilizations marking the 50th anniversary of the 1968 student massacre. In Austin, Texas, students confronted far-right trolls with Young Conservatives of Texas who were holding a pro-Kavanaugh rally on campus, and some students engaged in destroying their signs. See an article on Autonomous Students of Austin, Texas for more information about the far-right students that were there. On October 3rd, anti-colonial water protectors shut down Line 3 construction yet again. See their Facebook page for photos and videos of the action. Finally, encampments have begun to spring up against Kavanaugh outside of Senate offices. Tomorrow, there are scheduled walkouts taking place. And now for some upcoming events. On Thursday, October 4th, a mass mobilization will take place in solidarity with the PSU occupation in Portland and to demand that police be disarmed. See our show notes for more information about the mobilization at Portland State University. On Sunday, October 7th, a mass anti-racist and anti-fascist mobilization will take place in Montreal starting at 3 p.m. at Berry Square. More information in our show notes. On Monday, October 8th, the trial for the Vaughn 17 will begin in Delaware. October 15th through the 18th, there will be an anti-colonial land defense action camp. You can see our show notes for how to get involved and who to email to apply. From October 19th through the 22nd, there will be a gathering in West Virginia to discuss ongoing resistance to pipelines. On Saturday, October 6th, there will be a mass mobilization against the alt-right group Resist Marxism returning to Providence, Rhode Island. See our show notes for more information and be aware that Patriot Prayer is supposedly shipping themselves out from Washington. On Saturday, October 20th, celebrate the 20th anniversary of the LA chapter of the Anarchist Black Cross. It's going down in La Puente, California. See our show notes for more information on where it's happening. Until next time, we will see you soon. Enjoy the interviews. Okay, we're joined now with somebody from Tidewater IWW. We're going to be talking about autonomous disaster relief efforts in the town of Lumberton. This has been ongoing for a couple of weeks. You just want to introduce yourself and I guess what brought you out to the disaster zone?
My name's Jenna, and I'm a delegate for the Tidewater GMB. IWW also work with a group called the Tidewater Solidarity Collective up in Hampton Roads, Tidewater, Virginia. And pretty much what brought us there was about a week before the storm hit, every model that was out, you know, on the weather channels was pretty much indicating that we were going to be the place that it made landfall. So, you know, we were like running around trying to help people in evacuation zones and like, you know, build supplies to take care of our area. And then the storm shifted south at like the absolute last minute and took like the, you know, track that nobody thought that it was going to take. So we were like, well, you know, now we have all this stuff and we've raised all this community support, so we have to take it to the people who actually got hit by the storm. It was then that someone, a comrade of mine from elsewhere in Virginia, was like, hey, do you want to be on this conference call with these mutual aid disaster relief people? And I was like, hell yeah. So I got hooked up with those folks, and, you know, pretty much it was just a roller coaster from there. We found out about the need in Lumberton and the effort that was already being built there by the local community, which is a majority Lumbee Indigenous American community. And these folks had done relief, you know, for their county back during Hurricane Matthew also. And we were hearing in our networks that, you know, they were being neglected by the media as well as by other disaster organizations. And so, you know, that's where we headed to. And once we got down there, we saw that the community had already started to build a pretty amazing grassroots effort there. And we decided that we wanted to basically just help them and amplify what they were doing however we could.
Awesome. Can you describe how, you know, you said that people had not fully recovered from a hurricane several years ago. You know, why is that? Was it because of, you know, institutional poverty or just the continuing effects of colonialism? What led to people not being able to rebuild 2 years on and then being hit with this storm now?
Right. You know, obviously, as an outsider, I can only amplify for you what I've seen and been told by the people there. But the stories I've heard over and over again are that, you know, so many people, they lost everything during Hurricane Matthew, and then they just had barely put their life back together and lost everything all over again. Some people had not recovered. As far as your question about, you know, systemic poverty versus the hurricane, what I heard from a lot of people was that that line is really hard to identify. And I saw that for myself. And I think that a lot of it, the handling of Hurricane Matthew, aside from those community-led mutual aid efforts, was, you know, on the government end, just terrible. FEMA was offering people who had lost everything $500, $600 checks as though, you know, that's going to fix anything. There's a deep mistrust between people I talked to in the community and FEMA and the government agencies because of what happened after Hurricane Matthew. Also, like, just the continued effects of climate disaster and climate change really can't be understated. Everyone said after Hurricane Matthew 2 years ago that that was a 7-year flood, you know, that it wouldn't happen again. And here 2 years later, it happened again. So a lot of people there are bracing for the fact that it probably is going to happen again in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, I think people really need to understand that, I mean, a lot of people that have had their homes affected by the storms, I mean, you know, they may never recover from that. Like, they may not get insurance. You know, they may not get any type of assistance, like, you know, their home is destroyed or it's flooded or it's got black mold in it. And if they don't have the money to fix it, they're really in a bad place.
Yeah. And that's one of the really big pushes that the community and the out-of-town volunteers are thinking about right now, is really getting in and mucking out these houses, you know, ripping out the carpet and the drywall and using mold abatement materials to to make sure that these places are safe. There are whole neighborhoods that are being condemned that have been deemed unsalvageable, but there are still people living in homes where, you know, black mold is already crawling up the walls. And that's obviously a really big health concern. So one of the things people are really, really trying to do is get together crews of people that are willing to come and just you know, gut these flooded homes and help in that way.
Can you talk about just how people are on the ground? You said that they were already self-organizing. Can you just talk a little bit about what that looked like? And just in general, just the autonomous disaster relief efforts, did people set up spaces to distribute goods? Was there sort of like a mobile system of getting stuff out? What exactly were people on the ground doing outside of the state to make sure that people's needs were getting met?
Yeah, the folks that I hooked up with on the ground, both locally and the out-of-towners, are dedicated to grassroots autonomous, you know, mutual aid relief. The slogan is solidarity, not charity. And so one thing that the local people really wanted to focus on, since they knew the area, was that, you know, there were distribution centers that had been set up in churches and maybe fire departments and other places, but everyone can't get to those distribution centers. So we really wanted to focus, and they really wanted to focus, on those people who couldn't get out to where the aid was set up. So our location was kind of used as an out distro, where we would send truckloads of stuff and teams of people out with kayaks, canoes, high clearance vehicles, and really get to those places where people hadn't seen any relief and they were trapped. The county is very large. Much of it is really, really rural and spread out. And so if you don't have a car there even before the flood, you know, you're not really having much luck getting places. So our core goal was to really get to those untouched communities, and a lot of the places that we've gone, we heard from people, you know, you're the first help that we've seen, you're the first people that have come to check on us. We heard that a lot.
Just walking away from this, I mean, what do you think? You know, unfortunately, as you brought up, you know, none of this stuff is going away anytime soon. In fact, there was a report that was just released in the Washington Post where the Trump administration had even written that they expect, you know, by the end of the century, you know, temperatures to rise by 7 degrees Celsius, and basically just admitting that climate change is very real, and that their reasoning for basically brushing it aside is that, according to the Trump administration, that, you know, the damage is already done, and that, you know, we might as well make as much money as we can before the world ends, I guess. But I'm just curious, in your estimation, like, what could autonomous efforts do in the future in the face of these storms? Like, is the major thing to do to rebuild now? Or, you know, what do you see us doing in the future to help out even more, I guess?
I think, honestly, it might sound like a cop-out answer, but an even larger version of what's already happening, like the seeds of what needs to happen are there. It's truly a capacity issue, and the more people that come to do it, the more we'll get done. But I know that, you know, this situation is only going to continue to get worse, and the need for autonomous disaster relief is only going to grow. And what I've seen personally, is that it's in these disaster situations that there is an enormous capacity for people in the community to come together through solidarity and mutual aid, and they're very much doing that there. And that leads to other conversations. You know, people are, one of the community leaders, you know, said to me one night, looking around the warehouse packed full of supplies, what if we could do this all year round? What if we could always do this? And that's the way that they're thinking down there. And I think that's something that we need to continue to do, is to grow this idea that mutual aid happens even when there's not a disaster, and that more disasters are coming. And the only way we're going to weather that is together.
Right. Do you just want to talk about, if people are interested in trying to help out specifically in Lumberton and then beyond, where can they donate to, or where can they bring supplies to so they get there?
Okay. Right now, there is a Venmo account set up with a group called Interfaith Alliance for Climate Justice. Mm-hmm. They're collecting and handling money for the Lumberton effort. Their Venmo is at Interfaith Climate Justice. They also have a fundraiser set up on Facebook on their page, the Interfaith Alliance for Climate Justice. And as far as donating supplies, there are a few mailing addresses set up around that Mad Relief had set up. I know that there's one in Asheville. Firestorm Books was accepting shipments to there. And there is also an Amazon wish list, which is posted up on that page that I gave, the Interfaith Alliance. And a lot of folks are sending that way. And other than that, we're just seeing people ride out from affinity groups all over the country, bringing, you know, their own car full of supplies. So it's really coming in from a lot of different sources. Sources within their community also have stepped up, churches and community organizations there.
Awesome. Anything else do you want to say or plug?
Again, I just really want to emphasize the amazing work that I've seen the people in Lumberton and in Robinson County doing to take care of their neighbors. And I would love to put y'all in touch with some of those people. They would love to talk to you, and they can tell you, you know, far more than I can about the future ideas that they have for that community, because I think that's one of the big stories there, too, is the stuff that they're planning for the future.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds great. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Okay, we were talking to an Antifa super soldier out of Denver, Colorado. We're going to be speaking about a demonstration that took place in the Denver area last week. It was a dance party that the Proud Boys attempted to attack. It didn't go so well for them. So, just kind of set the scene for us. What exactly happened?
All right, so on September 15th in Denver, a group called Major League Liberty, they're like an alt-right, like ultra-nationalist kind of social media platform, along with some Proud Boys, held a rally at the Capitol to protest what they call the censorship of conservatives. This was in response to Alex Jones being deplatformed by, it was like Twitter and Apple and like a lot of large platforms, just that they weren't going to allow people to get content from Alex Jones. They were calling this censorship, so they had a rally at the Capitol. In response, community members had a good night. A resistance dance party that started down on 16th Street Mall about 3 hours before their rally was supposed to happen. People had a mobile sound system with them. And after a lot of outreach and, you know, multiple different groups were involved, we still had a lot of problems trying to get people into, like, one area, like, on time and be in the same spot. So we only had maybe 10 people with us going down the 16th Street Mall. And so for people who aren't familiar with Denver, there's like basically a big strip that goes through the city that's a giant mall that leads all the way to the Denver Capitol and Civic Center Park. Right as we started at the clock tower, it was on the Arapaho, there was immediately a Proud Boy antagonizing us, getting like way up in our faces, getting in our personal space, touching us, just generally antagonizing us, and we could see other Proud Boys in the restaurants and bars around there wearing their Fred Perry's. You can tell they're Proud Boys because they're wearing the black and gold Fred Perry shirts, and also several unmarked SUVs filled with law enforcement, unmarked but still pretty obvious, just sitting. And so the whole thing just really seemed like a big setup for us to be ambushed by them. And it seemed like they had sent bait, as in Proud Boy, hoping that one of us would take, you know, and maybe try and like punch him or do something. So we marched down to the end of the mall, still following us, nobody's touched him yet. There's no cops around on the mall, which is pretty surprising if you look at the history of how the police suppress radical protest movements, and even not so radical protest movements It just seems pretty weird that there was no visible police presence. But it seemed pretty obvious to everyone that we were still being watched. So by the end of the mall, this Proud Boy decided to actually assault one of the party goers and took one of their flags and ran off. And so we continued on. Eventually, we go to the state capitol and the base there decide that they're going to deny us entry, even though it's still 2 hours before the permit starts. So they deny us entry and then actually come and unplug the sound system. There's a lot of arguing, obviously, for that, and a lot of shit talk. And then, finally, we told the people said that they weren't going to move until they got the system working. So they continued to move. Everyone decided to go back, regroup in, Civic Center Park. Use the bathroom and try to figure out what people were going to do. So then they decide, so originally this march was supposed to stop, there's the state capitol, and then there's City Park, but in between that, there's a park called Veterans Park, or I believe they call it Liberty Park on Google Map, but there's a obelisk in the middle of it. And that was originally where we were going to meet up with other people who had showed up to demonstrate against the Proud Boys and Major League Liberty. On our way crossing the street, back over into this park, a group of 10 Proud Boys basically came down from the Capitol, or at least the direction of the Capitol, when they didn't need to be there. Like, they chose to come down from the Capitol, and later we would find out that they've been egging them on to do that. I can't really go into the details of the conflict that happened, but what I can say about it is that two Proud Boys had to go and sit in an ambulance, and seven anti-fascists arrested. One was detained. No Proud Boys or any other fascists were arrested, really, to the surprise of no one. Later it turns out, so there's this really, really shitty other media outlet that was present at this, they called the Frosty Report. And so these guys go around, they're kind of like pro-NRA. Well, they definitely, they have this like really crappy media platform. And they usually would kind of go around to any of the Never Again protests that were organized by like younger liberal students and harass them, basically. These people were at this rally and they decided that they were going to live stream the rally, and that during the rally, one of the state cops came up to like give them a kind of like rundown, like your deal kind of situation for the Proud Boys. And one of the cops turns to the Frosty Report and says, "Turn your camera on."
Right.
And so then the Frosty Report's like, for reason, doesn't do that, right? And then, and out of his back, turn to the Frosty Report's less reading, basically makes a statement saying, you know, it's in the write-up, I can't remember the exact statement, but it was pretty much to the effect of, like, you know, we want to fight too. Let me try and find an actual statement of what he said here.
Basically, they said, like, if you want to fight, stick around. We have some people you can fight. It was unclear because when I first saw that video, I thought he was referring to the police themselves, but everybody was saying no, he was referring to anti-fascists that were going to show up later.
Yeah, I think that's how a lot of people took it. And I also think, obviously, like, whoever put him on suspension took it that way.
It's very clear that, you know, the police were taking a certain stance with, you know, that side.
Yeah, and so that alt-left Twitter account that ended up posting that also claims that the police were encouraging them to go to, there's a piano bar nearby called Charlie Brown's, and the police were encouraging them to go to Charlie Brown's, wait there for 45 minutes, wait till the police leave, I told the Proud Boys to go and patrol the park, to come try and find anti-fascists to fight. So it was definitely like they were being encouraged to do it. So they split up into two groups. And the first group that we encountered came up to us, but eventually got the state cops made them leave and told them they had to go back to the state capitol, which was across the street. And then a second group of them came up. Now, this group claims that they were coming from Charlie Brown's and they were just like innocently walking back from the restaurant. But if you actually look where Charlie Brown's is, it's like completely out of the way. As opposed to like if you were actually just walking by, there'd be no reason for them to walk over to where they were. So like they came to start some shit is what they did. And then of course tried to play victim. When things didn't really pan out the way that they had hoped.
Right. Well, do you have any other thoughts on the mobilization itself? We appreciate you coming on and sharing.
I wanted to mention this part because this part was somewhat disturbing. Within a few days after this rally, it turned out another journalist had exposed people from Walker Stapleton's back. Were there to recruit for their campaign. And so Walker Stapleton is currently the Colorado State Treasurer. He manages the state employee pension, PARA, which has been in jeopardy. And he's all the great-grandson of the Klansman mayor of Denver, Benjamin Stapleton, who was the mayor of Denver for five consecutive terms. Or, sorry, not consecutive, five terms. During two different periods, and he's running for governor now. So there's also State Rep Alexander Winkler, who's with North Glen, and a GOP, Mark Barrington, also spoke at this rally. So one person who's actually an official spoke at the, and another person who's running. But like, while this article is from Colorado Polls. There's a ticker of a young fascist named Shane Reeves who has traveled to that recent station in Portland for sitting there wearing a Pinochet Did Nothing Wrong t-shirt
right.
While these guys are sitting there giving speeches.
Well, thanks again for coming on, and we'll talk to you soon. Okay, we're joined here today with somebody from the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement in New York City. We're going to be talking about the Vaughn trial that's going to start in 2017. There was an uprising that kicked off in the Vaughn Correctional Facility. One guard was killed. Prisoners there issued a set of demands. They discussed, abysmal conditions inside the correctional facility, and they also mentioned the coming to power of Trump. So this was like a really big thing that happened in early 2017. And since then, people have been building support, building capacity to support people that are going to be going on trial soon. There's been several things on It's Going Down that have been written. We actually have one podcast interview with a former inmate from Vaughn that got out that talked about the uprising. And we've also published some stuff, some zines, and also posters and information on how to write people. But just to kick off, can you just tell us a little bit of background about the uprising and what all happened at the Vaughn Correctional Facility in 2017?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, like before the uprising itself, the people inside had been staging protests for relatively modest demands. They were looking for basic human rights, a really small increase in pay for their mandatory labor, access to education and rehabilitation, basic medical care, and just generally less violence from the guards. And after a series of kind of like sit-ins and peaceful style protests, their requests weren't met. And what happened that day was that there was a takeover of the C building. The people inside erected barricades. There was a 20-hour standoff, and in the end, the correction officers responded by bulldozing the barricades. And then, you know, pretty much charging all the people who they say were involved with very egregious charges, which they're now facing trial for. And in the aftermath of the uprising, they faced a lot of repression immediately. They were beaten. They were denied medical care, food, access to programs and services. And that's something that kind of continues to today, the kind of retribution and retributive acts by the guards, which has been really difficult for them to get ready for their trial.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between the Attica uprising, I would say, just in the, you know, the storming of the area, you know, the loss of life. But also, these prisoners, I mean, they were calling into, like, nearby news stations and issuing demands. I believe there's a video, you can find it online somewhere, that's basically just the audio of them calling into the news, talking about what's going on. And also just the retribution they faced afterwards. I mean, just, you know, as with Attica, there was, I mean, it was horribly brutal, you know, after the uprising. But, I mean, they want to send a message very clearly that they're not going to tolerate this type of resistance.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really good that they are able to get their messages out in this way. And also, Chicago Anarchist Black Cross publishes a zine of their letters, and it's so good that they've been able to actually voice what happened, what their demands are, what's still going on, because of course we're not going to get any words of truth from the DOC or from the prison itself.
Right. Well, let's talk about, you mentioned Chicago Anarchist Black Cross. What have people been doing? I know RAM has been involved as well, but I mean, what have people been doing to make connections with prisoners to get ready for the trial?
We actually got involved a few months ago because we reached out as a support through the walls. So we have this program where we send like revolutionary literature and zines to people who are inside. And we had sent a zine catalog to all the people who are facing charges due to the Vaughn uprising. And many of them wrote back, requested literature, and then we ended up having a much longer correspondence and kind of getting more involved in the trial. But the Chicago Anarchist Black Cross has been involved for a little while, and we really appreciate that because that's how we found their addresses initially. And they've been really on top of getting out their new addresses, making a beautiful poster so that people can write to them and connect with them. And now that the trial date is getting a little bit closer, us and a few other groups have been kind of coordinating with the people inside facing charges, and then also sort of trying to coordinate with people outside to either like raise awareness and then to actually physically bring people to the trial so that there can be people supporting them sitting in on the courtroom proceedings.
Let's talk about the trial. It's going to take place in Delaware, which if you're not aware is close to Maryland. Looks like it's pretty close to Philadelphia and New Jersey. So people will be going there to support them. And on the 8th, which is a week from when this is being recorded, on the 1st of October, looks like you were saying jury selections will begin, so it'll probably be a slow process, but probably in a couple weeks after that, the trial will actually start.
Yeah, that's right. The jury selection starts on the 8th, and so we'd like to see a really nice showing of support that day to kind of kick it off and show them that these guys aren't alone, that they have like a nice network of support outside, and also that people are watching, and they we'll see if it is a kangaroo trial, and they will see if the people who are charged get due process or not. And we kind of want to show that really strongly from the start. So we're hoping to have a nice, strong showing on the 8th. And then we want to have people there every day. And the trial starts the 22nd for the first group of defendants. And we definitely want to have people have another strong showing of support that day, too. Have a rally outside. And they are separated into multiple groups because there's 17 people facing trial. So they're separated into groups kind of like the J20 defendants were, with the last trial starting actually February 11th. So this is going to be a really kind of long process. But what we're hoping is that if we could really come out with a lot of strength strength and a good showing for the first trial, that will help influence a good result, which will in turn influence the results of the other trials.
And real briefly, what are some of these people facing? I mean, are they facing like really intense charges? They're already locked up. So what are they facing on top of their existing sentences?
Because some of them are being charged in the murder of a corrections officer, and some of them are being charged with inciting riot, and they're definitely very serious charges. What's really wonderful is that all of them, except for one, have decided to stick close together, to show complete solidarity with each other. They've been asked to turn against each other to give evidence against the other defendants, and all but one have refused, and they're being very, very strong in that stance and proclaiming their innocence. So this is really, like, incredible that they're facing, like, such strong charges, but they've decided the most important thing is for them to stick together and protect each other. And this is an incredible showing of solidarity from the defendants.
Awesome. Well, if people are in the area and they want to come out or they want to get involved somehow, who should they contact if they want to somehow show solidarity?
Yeah, definitely. They can email us. It's a bit of a long email. It's a revolutionary abolitionist movement at protonmail.com. Mm-hmm. Or they can message us or Ram Philly on Twitter or Facebook.
Okay, great. Well, anything else you want to talk about in relation to the Vaughn trial or anything else?
I guess, like, the last thing is kind of because we've been corresponding with several of the defendants, and it's been a really moving process because they very clearly see their case as an example of the horrendous prison system in America. And I can't imagine being in that situation, being locked up, being kind of violated by the guards on a daily basis, and then actually just thinking about other people and thinking about how this affects the broader prison population or how this affects the white supremacist state. And that's something that's been really touching about corresponding with them, is that they're thinking of this in the broader political picture, not just about themselves, but about all prisoners and about all cases. So it's been really meaningful to be able to reach out to people who I would definitely consider comrades inside.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks so much for talking with us about this important trial. And again, I mean, you know, this is a piece of history, and it's important that we all go out to support these people as they face, you know, some very heavy time.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Okay, we're joined here today with an organizer on Kent State that's going to be talking about the anti-fascist mobilization that just happened. There was somebody from the kind of podcast group Liberty Hangout, which, you know, often has like alt-right pro-fascist people on it. She was going to have an open carry rally on the campus. This is in Ohio, where it's actually not illegal to open carry, but they wanted to basically have a rally on the campus that was going to be joined by members of the Proud Boys and white nationalist groups like the American Guard. And let's just get into it. You just want to talk about, I think the first thing that people need to know is that this person is a former student, the organizer, but she's not currently a student on the campus.
Yeah, correct.
So how did this get started? How did a former student cause all this controversy? And why, if your goal is to educate people about their gun rights, which, you know, it's not illegal to open carry, why have an open carry rally on the Kent State campus? What was the goal of that?
So her big message has been, like, she's done this before with, like, open carrying on campus, and I guess our goal is to move this agenda of being able to close carry on campus, which you can't do that currently. You can't bring guns into buildings and stuff like that. But I think the reason that she's been able to kind of, like, become a center for all of this, because she's not a student, is that she could have just become a, like, figurehead kind of for, like, neo-Nazis and stuff to latch on to, like, under the guise of being, you know, pro-gun and stuff, but they also get to spread their own message. think that was a big thing with Joe Gibson almost coming.
Yeah. And what's, I think, interesting, too, is that I actually really, really appreciate the fact that, like, groups like Black Lives Matter and other organizers have stated, like, look, like, we're not opposed to people owning guns. We're not opposed to the Second Amendment. You know, we're not opposed to people open carrying. Like, what we're opposed to is these groups bringing out, you know, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, Proud Boys to our area to intimidate the population. You know, what does this have to do with gun rights?
Exactly, yeah. So a big thing of, like, why this, like, organizing on our part really got mobilized, because so many fascist people are going to show up. Like, there is a big movement on campus of, like, at least being kind of intimidated by, like, the open carry and stuff like that. Like, our campus has a history, and, you know, students, like, just don't feel comfortable, like, with that kind of demonstration. But definitely the fact that neo-Nazis is going to be there really played into, like, how we were able to mobilize so effectively.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, like, what was her... What was her retort to, like, why that they wanted to physically just march around campus with guns? Like, what did they actually think that they were going to get out of it? Because it seemed like they just wanted to troll people.
Honestly, that seems like it is. Like, I guess they just wanted to normalize this idea of, like, guns on campus and stuff, which, like, especially just, like, where it is, like, Kent State, like, I don't think that's something we need to normalize, guns on campus. Like, we got a deep history of that, and not... You know, not what the students are comfortable with.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about how did the university respond? Because, again, this is not a student. They wanted to have a rally on campus. So, you know, what were the next steps that happened after this came out? Because originally they canceled it, and then they came back around and said, like, no, we're still going to do it.
Yeah, so the big response on the part of the university was trying to charge Caitlin Bennett. I believe it was something like $14,000 or $1,400. I'm not sure exact number. But they wanted to charge her money for security and stuff, and that's why they officially canceled the event. But they still showed up, obviously, and we did as well. And I guess the next thing the university did was just trying to get as many police as they can there. And we saw, you know, cops from all over. Like, I heard there were some from Columbus. I saw a car from Cincinnati there, a police car from Cincinnati there. And there was well over 300 police there that day.
Right. But even though they didn't grant her a permit, because they were basically saying, like, well, we'll give you a permit, but you have to basically pay for the security. She backed away from that. But then she also said that they were still coordinating with the police, regardless of there not being a permit. So it's, I mean, de facto that they were there to facilitate her rally, even though there was no permit. So it was...
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So, like, even though she wasn't there officially with the university, the cops were on her side the entire time. Like, there was never a point where cops were facing her group. It was always against us.
Can you just talk about what all went down? It sounded like they kind of were a little bit late, and they amassed in a parking lot, and then they were blocked several times from marching, and then they eventually just went back to the parking lot.
Yeah, so we initially expected the rally to start around 2, but we had gotten word that she was still waiting for people to show up because I guess they didn't have as big numbers they thought. The numbers I heard on their side was around 2 o'clock. They only had about, like, 75 people and didn't feel like that was enough. Though I'm not sure, like, how many ended up being there throughout the whole day. Once they did get moving, though, we initially didn't think we were going to block them, but once we knew they were moving, we made a last-minute decision to kind of, like, charge up. Like, they were going through one part of the street, and we kind of, like, went parallel to them. And we ended up being able to get in front of them and blocking them. And I think that was really powerful. We, like, stopped them from being able to get into campus, really. They only got about maybe 300 or 400 feet from where they began, and we're only, like, on campus for about an hour.
And there was about 300 people on the anti-fascist, anti-racist side?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
That's awesome. So people were able to physically stop them from getting on the campus, and then after a while, they just decided to kind of go back to their cars?
Yeah, once we set up our blockade, police had urged Caitlin to just go back, and eventually both, like, through, like, our... kind of like intimidation of being there and the pressure we put on them, we were able to get them back to the parking lot.
And then what is the story with the gentleman? It looks like a 3%er militia type. he's seen, and this is one of the videos that's kind of gone a little more viral than the others, but he's seen kind of...
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Right, he's seen kind of like, it looks like they're, it's almost like a football drill where like people are kind of like pushing back against him, but then he tries to move and it looks like he's about to pull out a sidearm and people are able to stop him. I don't know if you want to speak to that, that incident.
Yeah, I personally wasn't there for that, but, I know some people who were there have heard stuff, and, it seemed just like they, like he was trying to get onto kind of like our side of like the police line, and we didn't want that, you know, in there. So people were trying to just kind of remove him from it. And eventually, like, after kind of a little bit of shoving, he was kind of like, we can't tell if he was guarding it or trying to pull it, but eventually a police officer did stand in, but he was not, like, under arrest.
Right. Has the university responded at all? Have they put out any statements about anything, or?
I have not seen any statements from the university, like, university-wide or to me. A fellow organizer that I know has spoken to, some admins, and as far as we know, they're not trying to do any additional like charges against any students who are there or anything like that.
I was just curious if you could speak to like the mood on campus in general. I mean, looking at the tweets, it just seemed people were kind of like, you know, why is the police and the administration kind of bending over to give these people a space? What are some average Kent State students and community members all thinking about this rally in general?
Honestly, it's kind of been like a double war, kind of like half of like the students I talked to and stuff like aren't like they're aware of it, but they didn't really know the severity kind of the situation and stuff like that. And it's kind of just like half for them, but the people who like were there didn't know like what's going on. Like this has been a super, like a very important event for them, and they really like want to make sure that she's not able like be on campus and intimidate us like that.
Right. Last question is just, you know, 300 people is a great turnout. I'm assuming that unlike the far right side, this is more of a regional and a local gathering as opposed to bringing people from, you know, all the way from Oregon and stuff like that. But has this brought a lot of groups together and like a larger coalition that maybe hadn't worked before, or is this just the continuation of relationships that have been in place for a long time?
So organizing on Kent has been pretty like disorganized over the last couple of years, but I just as a student, like a big thing for me has been trying to get like at least all the students together, and I think this event has only made both like all the student orgs on campus stronger, but it's also given us like access and contact to people outside of the university, and hopefully good friendships that'll continue into the future.
Awesome. Anything else you want to touch on or add?
I think that was it. This main thing is that hoping from here on out, like, we're going to have a strong presence on campus, like, a lot of solidarity and stand up for each other, and hopefully growing these relationships outside of campus, too.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.